As you can see, the title of today's lecture is Being and Doing. Now, we have already discussed this, so what we are really doing is revisiting the topic. We are revisiting a topic which is practically at the very basis of importance for anybody engaged in spiritual life. Now, generally when we are engaged in spiritual practices, we somehow or another become very much absorbed in doing things. And doing becomes an end in itself, or rather, it becomes a practice, a discipline, the way in which success is achieved. It becomes very active, it becomes very lively, it involves many kinds of different ways in which we can do things. Now, that in and of itself is neither good or bad, but when it creates a situation which is not advantageous for our spirituality, then we should try to understand why. Now, spirituality is a multifaceted affair. It's a multidimensional affair that will work on many different levels of our consciousness. The way in which spirituality manifests, sometimes people think it is a process or it is a symptom of a very specific form of consciousness, mainly the soul, the spirit within the heart, and only that energy is what counts. Now that seems to me to be actually a misconception, because the same persons will also be absorbed in disciplines and actions which are recommended as advantageous for the performance of spiritual practices. Now, that makes things complex. What shall we believe? Shall we believe that spirituality is a form of activity? Or shall we believe that spirituality is something else, as many other traditions speak about, peace within, quiet, meditational placidity, like on a lake of peace? Now, I personally don't think that being and doing are contradictory concepts or contradictory forms of engagement in spirituality. And as far as I know, most others don't think so either. But somehow in our minds or in our consciousnesses or in our understanding of spirituality, these conceptions can develop. Now, we are very aware of what it means to do things, to be active, to engage. And we're also quite aware of what it means to simply be. We've been practicing that in our meditations, in our exercises together. The problem is combining the two. How do we combine the two into a cohesive system that works, that gives us what we want in our daily lives, our spiritual lives? If you really wish to attain harmony in life, if you really wish to attain a compatible form of spiritual harmony, it would be very advantageous to understand being in a very specific way. Because between the two, being and doing, being is the foundation upon which all doing will manifest. Doing is a symptom. Being is the cause of that symptom. And I feel that this definition is fundamental to correcting various mistakes that we make in our spirituality. Now, when you think about bhakti yoga as an example, bhakti yoga is an art of action performed out of love. Now, love is the basis of bhakti, but love is a state of being. It is not something you do. You never say, I do love. Love is the fundamental root state of being of all beings, all living entities, everywhere. And that state is the fundamental characteristic of spirit. If you think about Radha and Krishna, if you think about Lord Chaitanya, if you think about any spiritual personality who deeply affects people, the fundamental quality and characteristic is their love. It is that love which sets these personalities apart from everyone else. For example, during the days of awe and reverence worship of the Supreme, God was that being far away who was all love, and we were these struggling personalities who didn't really have that love and were trying to attain it. And there is a lot of truth in that. For example, God is unconditional love. God, the Supreme, or any spiritual divine beings are so unconditional that their love does not depend on us being in any way or acting in any way or speaking in any way. Their unconditional love does not depend on the way we act, what we say, or even what we know. In fact, it doesn't depend on anything. It's causeless, which means it's not based on any dependencies. There's no strings attached. Now, this is a very unique and special situation because, after all, to find out such personalities who have such intense love and concern for all living beings that they do not require anything of us to love us is just so magnificent. Now, would one love divinity because of what they do, or is it because of what they are? Now we have new deities in St. Petersburg. We have new deities in other places. When these deities are before us, are we receiving from them and reciprocating with them because of what they do, or is it because of what they are, their being? Well, deities don't really do anything. They don't dance around the room, well, at least not before the usual eyes. They are not doing any particular kind of activity. They stand there and emanate their energy of love. They communicate with us on the level of heart-to-heart connection, soul-to-spirit connection. And we love them for that. We don't love them for their doingness. We love them for their beingness, that pure love that they are. People all over the world come before the divine because they know they will feel that love, they will feel wanted, they will feel appreciated, they will feel needed, they will feel connected. Now, I'm not saying that people have no motives for coming to God or to divine personalities. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that the basic fundamental reason that people do approach the Supreme is they know the Supreme loves them and cares. That's the point. Otherwise, why ask? We see in the Supreme a personality or personalities whose very being is everything we want. Now, let's relate that to us, all of us, regular folks, regular people of the world. Now, you might say, and of course, to a certain degree, you would be right. You might say that, well, I love what you do. Well, let's just analyze that a little more. Let's say that person is somebody who was a music group or a theater actor or a movie performer. You would love their manifestation. You would love the entertainment. You would love what they're giving you. So, they are offering you something that you like, it satisfies you in some way, so you love what they do. But you don't exactly love the mood, or rather the emotion in which they do it. After all, they may be doing it purely for money. They may be doing it purely to cheat you. For example, you may love a car salesman who cheats you when he sells you a car. Now, when a person is just a very, very loving person, a person who works for the sake of others, or who cares for others, you love what they do, but there's a reason why they do it. A person who cares about others, a person who renders service, or wishes to do things for others out of a selfless kind of way, is somebody whose love within is the basis upon which that desire to be of service manifests. I was saying that the person who does things for others, who does it out of love, who does it out of care and concern, the thing that fuels that, yeah, that powers that rendering of service to others, is their basic love within. And that basic love within is something which is of their spiritual essence. It's a very basic quality, that quality of care, that quality of feeling that there is a oneness between us that cannot be ignored. Now, let's take the example of a small child who comes up to you and just gives you a drawing or maybe some small piece of plastic as a gift in love. You are so overwhelmed by that simple expression of love. You don't care about it's just a piece of plastic. You don't care about it's just a simple little drawing of no meaning. You care because it's just something so pure and so beautiful that you just love it. Now, I know that there are examples in the bhakti tradition of the fact that the Supreme does not look so much at the what you are doing as much as the love with what you are doing it. And it's easy to understand that as a concept. It's easy to understand that philosophically. But somehow that basis of bhakti gets lost in the translation. What gets lost in the translation is the essence of what the whole affair is about. And examining why that happens is the point of re-examining the concepts of being and doing. Now, someone might think that ultimately you have to do things to get to the destination. You have to do things to be able to experience love. Hard work, action, discipline, continuous engagement. This will solve everything. This will bring us to the point we want to be of pure love. Now, think about that for a second. There seems to be something essentially wrong with that idea. Yet it's very hard to pin the reason for it, because it makes sense. You do this effort, you get this result. Like you go to school, you get a degree. It makes sense. Work is rewarded. Now that sounds very fruitive to me. That sounds like a fruitive activity. You perform some work, you get a fruit of the work, you get a result of the work. You perform some discipline, you get some result. Now, just consider how love manifests around us in this world. Now, I know that some people will say there is no love in this world. They think there's only lust. I feel sorry for such people because they have no connection with that which is the essence of life, that which is the life of life. But for those of us who don't have that philosophy, How does love actually manifest? Did you work to fall in love? Did you perform some discipline to fall in love? Did you do some specific formulated activity to fall in love? How does one fall in love? Why are there no books with the title, How to Fall in Love? I would say that would be one of the most difficult books in the world to write, because you would have to just babble with some idea, would have no connection with reality. You don't need great intelligence to fall in love. You don't even need to have the physical capacity to move to fall in love. You don't even have to be born yet to be in love with your mother. It's just a natural state of being. Two people, their energy come in proximity. Doesn't need to be physical proximity. And there is a compatibility there. There is a connection there. And there is a loving bond that develops. If you just think about it, when men and women are trying to make a connection with each other, they're desperately trying not to do something wrong, to say something wrong, do something wrong. They're trying to keep up the time, the amount of time and the amount of good energy between them as possible until they can really connect. And all the actions they do, like to go on a date, these things are just excuses, more or less, to come closer together. And when they do succeed in coming together, they do actually develop that love. For some period of time, there's no need for them to do anything because they're in love. They don't need to do anything. They can just sit and look at each other for hours. They can just walk somewhere down the street together or just eat together, not even being hungry. They're just very satisfied in their love. Now, then another stage appears, the stage at which they want to start doing things, because life is also based upon practicality. I mean, no matter how much in love you are, after a while you get hungry. And you have to have a place to live, and you have to have some income. You can't be living in the clouds all the time. You have to come back down to earth and make some steps. So there was this feeling to be together. There was this connection. There was this love. And then there were activities, because you've got to maintain the structure within which this relationship can continue. So the being entered into doing, with being as a fundamental foundation upon which the doing will manifest. Now, how do people get divorced? How does it break up? The being changes its connection. It doesn't want to be with the other being. And the, therefore, doing transforms. Usually that happens. Of course, I would be very, very presumptuous to make this a generalization in all cases, and I'm really just trying to give an example. But this happens when those who are busily engaged in doing do not nurture their being, and especially their being together. Doing becomes such a priority that being is set aside. So here is a rule which is universal. Never take being for granted. Because being is so powerful, as soon as that state is transformed, all of the doing is irrevocably affected. Now, let's discuss again how love of divine beings might manifest from this example we've just gone through. Let's start backwards. How would one who has great love for the divinity lose it? Now, people have said It's because of enviousness. People have said it's because of lust. Perhaps these words do define to some extent the difficulty, but let's just take that example at the end of our last discussion and apply it directly to how it might be in relationship with the divine. Let us say we are given a field within which we may act. We become so absorbed in our actions, we become absorbed in doing, and we neglect our being. Now, which way do we connect with the divine? Through doing or through being? Again, being is the basis of everything. So when we are absorbed in doing, our being becomes disconnected. We disconnect from the divine because our being no longer feels that harmonious resonance. Let's go deeper into the causes of why this happens. Why would someone who's engaged in that doing, who has connection with the divine, why would that resonance transform? What would be the cause? It seems inconceivable that it would happen. And in fact, this very question is discussed in all religions at one point or another. And because, just see the interesting logic of this, because this disconnection has taken place, it is assumed that it is because the living being is fallen, sinful, basically evil, basically bad, an envious and lustful person. I would suggest that this is a human creation. This is the creation of human beings. And it is at the fundamental core of all religions which are based upon that negativity, that negative creation. I would suggest that the reason for this is that people just aren't aware enough or honest enough to understand the way they work. So I would like to suggest an alternative understanding based totally on what we just discussed. So we are acting, we are doing. Even in the state of being, where we are fundamentally in harmony with the divine, we are still doing, because doing is there at all times. Now, when one is like doing like that, you will see that there's always a possibility of fault, because it's impossible for anybody to do everything perfectly at all times, unless, of course, you have a very universal understanding of things. Of course, you could see things from the other way and say that everything is working perfectly according to the divine plan all the time. That's not the point I'm trying to make. I suppose I'm quoting from the Bhagavad Gita, every endeavor is covered by fault as fire is covered by smoke. You can say every doing is covered by fault. It's an axiomatic truth of existence that every act of doing will have within it, by its very nature, some kind of defect. There will always be something that's not perfect about it. Especially when you consider human relations. There'll always be some kind of friction. There'll always be some kind of distrust or some kind of competition. Now, just consider, for example, the Goswamis have discussed about actions in the spiritual world. Now think about the discussions, think about the relationships there. You'll hear that it will be based upon, to a very large extent, talking which is filled with various forms of friction. And if there isn't any, it's created. And even the creation of rivals that shouldn't even be there. I'm talking about, for example, like Radharani and Chandravali. You'll have this rivalry created. You'll have the left wing, the right wing gopis. You'll have, Krishna being the bad person in a certain pastime with Radha, and you'll have separation, connection. All of this will be created because it's the nature of existence. So within that being, when it manifests in doing, there's always something which is like a friction, or is like an obstacle, or is like a problem, or is like an endeavor, or is like a challenge. Now you can define that as a defect. You can also accept it as the nature of existence. There's a big difference between the two, and it's totally related to the main point of this discussion, which is how the harmonious connection becomes a divorce. I am doing. I am engaged in so much doing. And in my doing, there's defects. And as these defects accumulate, they start to affect me in a very deep way. We have this idea of ourselves as perfect, that we have to fulfill a certain form of perfection. And when these defects accumulate, when these faults accumulate, they start to rock the very foundation of our self-understanding, our self-imaging. And as this series or sequence of defects start to accumulate, we start to develop the idea of ourselves as being not only imperfect, not only making mistakes, but being bad because of it. So our conception, our self-conception of a beautiful spiritual soul starts to become replaced by the self-conception of this fallen, defective, imperfect, and not good person. And as we develop this conception, the resonance between ourselves and the divine starts to change, because the divine resonance is inner peace and acceptance and love for the self. And when we lose the love for the self because we start thinking of the self as, or us as, bad, we're no longer in harmony. So we feel bad about ourselves. And when we feel bad about ourselves, we do things which we ordinarily wouldn't do. Some people eat a lot. Some people drink a lot of alcohol. Some people take intoxication. Some people just go insane trying to drown their worries in sex. Some people just work like mad and accumulate money thinking that will give them back their self-prestige and esteem. And to drown our personal defects, we have to divorce ourselves to a certain extent, or even a very great extent, from the divine, because it's such a disharmonious kind of activity. It's a totally different kind of frequency. Now, this divorce was not initiated by the divine energy. It was initiated by ourselves, because we became entangled in what we were doing and we forgot our being, because we took doing as predominant and not being. It is not enviousness. It is not trying to imitate the Supreme. It is not these very simplistic understandings. It is the very deepest, basic, fundamental self-conception that transforms, that creates the separation. And this is based on the misconception of doing as being significantly important as a defining factor in my existence. Whereas in reality, it's the being which is the fundamentally significant factor in my existence. Why is it that there's never a total disconnection between the divine and the living entity? It's because the divine energy knows that you're just being silly and does not give you up because of that. And the divine is continually trying to support us, to have us have a good feeling about ourselves, so that we can connect again. Now, when we engage in being, in other words, when we go into a deep meditative state, when we just accept ourselves as we are, when we just accept ourselves as the spiritual energy we are, there's no room for bad. There's no room for fallen. It is not that in that state where you're in contact with your spiritual energy, you can even conceive of all of this which is born of doing. You immediately see the difference between that which is created by the doing aspect of existence and that which is actually there all the time in our being. I've heard again and again and again, I've done so much, I've worked so hard, I've done everything right, still it's not working in my spiritual life. Why? What am I doing wrong? Exact words. Well, in the context of what I just said, it's because we have neglected the being for the sake of the doing, out of some reason that we're thinking doing is the way to being. Whereas in reality, being is the key to doing. What's the cure? What to do? But actually, there is a cure. To come to the state of connection with being. To just be. The more you can just be, the more you can just feel connection to your spiritual energy in that meditative state. That's why I've been emphasizing that meditative state. The easier it will be to infiltrate all doing with that energy. This is not a big work. This is not a big endeavor. This doesn't need any tools. This doesn't need any places. This doesn't need anything that will assist you. It's just a meditative state in which you come to feel your spiritual being. The more you expand that spiritual being through every aspect of your life, through your relationships, through your work, through your house, through your community, even throughout your country, your world, it's just an expansion of your being everywhere. Instead of trying to go from the outside in, work to being, go from the inside out, being to doing. And in reality, this is the definition of bhakti. This is actually bhakti yoga, but somehow it got lost. And all of this doing became so entangled up with our very existence that the coming in contact with our being became such a monumental endeavor, it exhausted us. Because in reality, coming in contact with our being is the, by definition, the easiest thing in existence because it takes no effort at all. There is no work involved in it. What could be easier than this? And yet, I remember when I was doing meditations for one society in Sweden, and some people were there who were very expert meditators, and we were doing the I Am meditation. Their comments were very, very funny. They were saying that we have been meditating for years, and we've been doing all kinds of fancy meditations, but this one was the absolute hardest one they've ever done, because there was nothing to do. Therefore, it all bases upon total, complete relaxation. Relaxation is the first and foremost key, because you have to relax all of this tension to do, tension to accomplish, tension to work right down to the core where you let it all go. You just let it go and you come in contact with your being. Nothing whatsoever to do, nothing to think, nothing to gain, nothing to lose. Pure being. Now you can't do that all the time. I know that. You know that. Everyone knows that. But when you are able to come in contact, when you are able to experience that being for some period of time, and you let it permeate your whole existence, everything will come into relevance. It'll all make sense. You'll be able to focus on anything properly. Now, this is the key. Being is the key to everything. Just remember that. Being is the key. Being is the key to bhakti. Being is the key to devotion. Being is the key to success in all life. And doing is a symptom of our being. The meditation we're going to do after this break is going to be about being and expanding that being into every aspect of our lives. Here's an interesting thought that I'd like to leave you with at this point. I once had a discussion with some person, and also this question arises often. What is friendship? What does it mean to have friends? What does it mean to be friends? How does it manifest? What do you do? I always give this definition because it is my realized understanding of what is friendship. Friends are those who you can just hang out with, doing nothing, and feeling really good about it. That is a very rare quality. I know when I was, managing and being a kind of big shot in ISKCON, I very rarely had that kind of experience. But there was one person I had that experience with. I remember Sridhar Swami used to just come in my room and he'd lay down on one couch and I'd lay down on the other couch and we'd just simply hang out with absolutely nothing to do, didn't even have to talk, didn't even have to do anything, and we had a marvelous time. It was just a unique experience. So what is that born of? That's born of your being. You just are satisfied being together. You don't need to do anything. And when you have to entertain your friends, when you have to do things together, otherwise there's no friendship, this is not really friendship. Okay, you can call them friends. Yes, they're friends. But I'm talking about that deepest level of friends, which is just to just be happy together. What's friendship with the divine? To just be and be connected with the divine and just be happy in that connection. You don't have to do anything. But you can't stay in that meditative state forever, unless you are a yogi doing that, of course. So you have to act, just bring that energy with you everywhere. And people will love you for what you are, not for what you can give them. Of course, that's a controversial point, and maybe even I don't agree with it all the time, but the point is that being is the basis, doing is the manifestation, yet they are both connected as source and emanation. So I want to, at this point, take a break. We always like to take a break. And I would like to play Bhadra Hari's album, Om Purnam. He's now also on our website. And we will come back at the hour. And unless there are extremely significant questions related to the point, I would like to go into the meditation. I don't at all mind answering questions. That's not the point. I just want them related. I have a few questions here. Here's an interesting question. I suppose one could consider it the answer obvious, yet perhaps it needs to be stated. The question, I'm going to skip the exact details, but the question relates to the difference between divine love, for example, the supreme in the living entity or the divinity in this living entity or whatever you want to define it as, and human love. Now, we all have in our minds, we all have in our hearts the idea that divine love is extremely unique, extremely special. It's never-ending, it's eternal. It cannot be diminished in any way. It's unconditional. Let's say there's this living entity who loves another living entity. Now, that is in the context of two beings who have a physical relationship within this world of activity, within this world of action. Now, actually, I just realized my answer is not at all obvious, so I take back what I said in the beginning, because there's a very, very subtle point going on here which needs to be stated clearly. Okay, let's say in your natural state you're intimately connected with the Supreme or the Divine because that's your nature. The connection is your nature. It's the axiomatic fundamental state of all spirituality. So that means because we are not now, if we are, in that state, because we have divorced ourselves to some extent from that state, that the connection seems to be modifiable. It's possible to modify that connection. So that means the connection between the divine and the living entity is modifiable. So naturally, it would follow the connections between individual living entities are modifiable. Now, we've already discussed how the relationship of love between that living being and the divine is modified. We gave some suggestion how that is possible to be modified. So we already understand that. So in a similar manner, the relationships between living entities themselves, no matter what their status, is modifiable. Now, some feel so well together, they don't modify it. They stay in that loving relationship through this lifetime and even lifetime after lifetime. Real loving connection doesn't die. It can be modified, but it doesn't die. So you can have these connections between living entities lifetime after lifetime. You can have people coming together lifetime after lifetime, reconnecting, reestablishing their connection and love. And in fact, this is exactly what is happening. Lifetime after lifetime, you are meeting again and again people that you have this connection with. You come in contact, your energies connect, you immediately know, I love you, I love you. It's a long-term connection of energy that has nothing to do with the physical body. It may manifest through the physical body in this plane, but the connections are not dependent on the physical body because they are energetic connections of our essence. Our beings are connected, and that connection continues. Those connections of love are always there. They just rise and go beneath the surface periodically according to how we modify it by the circumstances or by our own personal self-image or self-conceptions. Usually people in individual relationships modify their relationships because either they have changed their conception of themselves or you have changed your conception of yourself or both have done it, causing the resonance between the two to be modified, which causes the connection to be disrupted. But if there's a real loving connection, if it has been established, a real loving connection, you may go for some time and then connect again, perhaps in another lifetime, perhaps even this lifetime, perhaps in between lifetimes. We all have our family of souls, our family, our groups, where we have these continuously appearing and disappearing relationships life after life. So sometimes in this life, you have the loving connections. Sometimes they modify. They may appear later. They may not appear. It depends on whether you actually had a connection or not. Now, ultimately, that connection we have with the Supreme or the Divine, the balance of all things, is so fundamental and so part of our nature, so part of our essence. We may disrupt it by modifying it due to our bad image of ourselves, but it's always there. Now, the universality of love is a complicated question to think about because there is a universal kind of a love, yet at the same time, we may tend to prefer to manifest it in individual cases. Our connection to the universality of love can be in a very general way. We can feel love for all beings, yes. But when those individual beings come before us into our field of consciousness, we may not prefer to have more than just that universal connection of love. The divine balance is connected to all beings everywhere. So there's always that connection, that relationship, that love. But we are not necessarily connected to faraway pieces in this puzzle of the balance of existence. That doesn't mean you can't create new connections. It doesn't mean you can't expand your connections. Of course you can. But you may not have had the opportunity to do so, or you may not have preferred to do so. So although I mean to say it may have seemed like an obvious kind of a answer to give, but in reality, it's a complex question, this way in which universal love and individual love may be understood. So one needs to understand the individuals in terms which the individuals can appreciate. That is the difference between us living beings and the divine, in a nutshell. So I think that question has been more or less answered. And here's a very interesting question. It's about the recycling of the consequences of those errors, those defects, those imperfections, which are continuously going on whenever we try to act. And I can give an answer in a very short statement, that so long as you continue to deal with these consequences on the platform of doing, it'll just get worse and worse and worse. And when one gets to the level of being and deals with these consequences on the level of being, all of this recycling, all of this huge construction of misconception will be dissolved away. This is the real knowledge that burns to ashes all the fire of accumulated reactions. I feel it's a mistake to use the word knowledge in that sentence, but I was using a familiar phrase. I would say this is the being that burns to ashes all accumulated junk that we've assembled in our consciousness for so long. Words have meaning, and these meanings point us towards certain philosophical constructions of concepts and ideas that we accept. And by modifying the word that you use to describe a particular concept, you sometimes are able to clarify the concept, because the misconceptions we cloak these words with are not available to us.